Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is gone from my sails, and no one's left to tell my tale.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back with part two with Dr. Chris Haklutube. If you haven't listened to part one yet, pause this one, go back to last week, listen to part one, and then you can proceed with part two, the conclusion. And hopefully you guys have enjoyed this one. This was fascinating for me, I'll be honest. As I said in the first episode, it's an embarrassing lack of knowledge on Native American spirituality and just Native American history in general. As a history person, somebody who loves history, my degree's in history, we just, unless you go out of your way and really search out information on the various tribes, of which there were many across North America, and really dig into that history. And or if you happen to be at a really good school that happens to offer courses and has good good academia in that regard, it's easy to go through life without really knowing much about it. And that's kind of true for a lot of different things, right? A lot of different subjects. It's very, very easy to walk through life just kind of oblivious and not really have a foundational understanding of that subject. And yet, we live in this day and age of technology at our fingertips. Like literally, I can't tell you how many times throughout the course of the day, I'm like, huh, I wonder. And then I pull my phone out and Google it, information is readily available. So, we really don't have much of an excuse anymore not to, quickly gain an understanding of something that we lack in. It's not like the ye olden days back when I was a kid, when you would have salesmen coming around door to door selling, books or like series of encyclopedia. I remember when I was in high school, breaking out the old encyclopedia to try to understand some sort of mathematical equation better. And, they were useful, they were helpful, sure, but like you can get way more information and it takes up way less space on your bookshelf. But they do look cool. You look like a learned person, by having a series of encyclopedias. welcome back for part two. Appreciate the support and love all the emails and DMs and social media comments we get. Helps us know that you're still out there and still listening. Still hard to believe. It's been over 7 years now, which is crazy to think about. I was talking to Adam the other day, and we had a couple things pop up on our social media just as a, hey, this time, at this date, 5 years ago or whatever. And it's hard. It's crazy to believe that so many of these different monumental, historical markers took place now years ago. So pretty wild to think it's almost been a decade and been going at this. So anyway, thank you guys so much for the support. As always, you know where to go, www.thedeconstructionist.com. Got the blog, got the web stores, the Patreon, all the backlog of episodes, all that good stuff. So go check it out and go support Dr. Haklutube and go check out some of the resources I provided in the show notes if you want to know more. Appreciate your support and interest in this subject. Next week, I'll be back with part one of the final two-parter of this season. Take a little break and be back again in the probably late summer, early fall is kind of what we're shooting for right now. So got a handful of episodes, about a third, I would say, of the episodes that we'll need for the end of the year recorded with some other ideas. But, sometimes you've got grand ideas and they don't come to pass, whether it's just booking issues or trying to find the right person, to cover a certain subject. So we'll see how it goes, but I am optimistic and I've already got a bunch of really good stuff in the can that I'm super excited to share. So some cool themes and ideas and guests coming on for the fall. So before we do that, got a few more episodes left, including this one. So let's get to it. Thank you for coming back and listening to part two. And without further ado, I give you Chris freaking Hakalatube.
This water I am treading is now my home.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like the communal aspect. One of the things that we've always talked about since we started the podcast is just regardless of where you are on your spiritual journey, you know, and obviously the podcast name is kind of the hijacking of an old philosophy term that we take to mean, you know, examining your faith from the inside, maybe perhaps removing some things that no longer work, but sort of, you know, shoring it up a little bit so it's more seaworthy, you know, for the storms ahead. And one of the things that that we've talked about is the absolute necessity of community, whatever that community might look like to you now. Maybe it's not going to church, but maybe it's gathering around a group of friends who can be truth tellers for you. But having that support of a group of people around you, even if it's in a Starbucks or something, you know. But I love that. I love that idea, that notion of community helping to assist you through the journey of cleansing yourself. I think that's really neat. So talk a little bit about, you mentioned storytelling, and obviously we go back to our storytelling tradition through by way of the Bible, you know, and the stories contained within and the lessons they have to teach us. So talk about the use of storytelling within Native American spirituality. Do they have like a creation story? I'm assuming they have some version of it. So what is that like?
Well, all kinds of creation stories across the globe, right? But even just thinking about North America, whether you have the story of Sky Woman in the Haudenosaunee or Six Nations, of a woman falling from the sky and being caught by birds and landing on the back of a turtle, and then either some being like a muskrat or a frog that dives down to the ocean floor to grab some mud to create some land because this woman is about to have a baby, right? And this muskrat or frog or animal dies in the process, right? So we have a sacrificial death or life that this person gave its life so that another might live as part of this very early story. You have other stories that come from the ground, right? That, and this is the Chota people or people from the ground, but a lot of Southwest and Southeast stories of people coming from mounds or coming from below the earth. And that there have been many generations or many attempts to do this earth, and that we're either the seventh generation or one generation, and we have to get this right because others have messed this up. You know, at the heart of the many different creation stories, again, all seem to emphasize the interrelationship of animals and humans and the earth. That the earth is our home, that the earth is our mother to some, you know, in various degrees, and that this is what happens. Life is able to grow and progress as things are in good harmony with one another, and chaos occurs and death happens when things are not living in right relationship with one another. So, you know, for indigenous traditions, largely it's an oral tradition. And so these stories, are also not even told all throughout the season, right? So many indigenous traditions, right? Some stories are only told in the winter months when people are gathering around the longhouse or the campfire, right? And otherwise, what are you doing listening to stories? You need to be out in the fields, you need to be hunting, right? There are stories about creation. There are stories about, you know, some are just fun animal stories that are about, like, this is why the Chota birds' feathers are, you know, cut the way that they are, right? Or this is why the raccoon is spotted the way that he is, or the alligator has its color, right? They're fun stories that explain why animals are the way they are. But they're some wise, like Aesop tales, right? That by watching these animals and telling stories about animals, they have something to teach us, right? Which not only becomes a vehicle for communicating moral lessons, but also become vehicles that further underline this importance that animals are persons that have something to teach you, that if you watch them and you see how they act, there's something that you can discern, not only just about how to learn about them, which is good in their own sake, but they're also moral idea. They're productive to think with as well. If not directly teach you, they're productive to think with. One of my Lakota friends talked about the ways in which he was out with his grandmother and his grandma and playing in the grass and in the flowers. And after watching her grandson play in the flowers, she said, well, go pick out me one of these flowers. And so he goes and picks up a flower and that he'd just been playing on, right? And pops up this flower and she smells it and like, oh, it still smells so beautiful. Smell this flower, right? And he smells this flower and says, even though you were running on it and stepping all over it, right? This flower still gifts itself and its perfume to you. And isn't this what love is like? Isn't this what forgiveness is like, right? And something comparable also with the tree, right? You think about these trees have these, you know, they're so tall and majestic, and yet there's this mystery and beauty that goes beneath the ground that we don't see, right? These deep roots that, you know, he was encouraged just when you're angry, right? Tell your story to your tree, hug the tree, right? There's part of that energy that the tree takes it in, right? And in its vast wisdom and roots, it's able to hold that, right? And there's a lesson to be learned that we can think with the power and strength and stability of trees and the importance of being rooted and rootedness in land and place and our stories and our culture that communicates valuable lessons to us. And what I love about these stories, right, that I think is reflective and helpful for even thinking about with the Christian story, right, is that they hold these stories with an open hand insofar as the meaning's not always given, right? It's up to the person listening to the story to figure out the meaning. And then really, I mean, don't we see this in the gospel stories where Jesus tells these parables and then says, thank you very much. I'll be here every Tuesday night. Tip your waitress on the way out, right? And the disciples are like, what was that about, right? And so Jesus is like, do you guys not get it? Do you not have any creativity or imagination to like apply this to your life? Okay, let me tell you what this story is, right? The farmer goes out and spreads his seed. This seed means this. Like, are you so wooden, right? And yeah. But, you know, I think about this also in sermons, right? Like, I find myself listening to a sermon and I will zone out, right? And there will be a piece of this sermon I'll listen to and I'm going to sit on that piece. It'll take me 5 minutes to come back and I'll catch up where the person is at, right? But there's a sense of, you know, the story is out here, the meal is prepared, and you're going to zero in on what you need, the nourishment that you need for that moment and the thing that you need to think with for that moment. And I think that's just so true to storytelling. But when we approach the gospel stories from this kind of Western Enlightenment or systematic theological position, right, we're trying to figure out those singular meaning that is going to produce that mathematical system of theology where everything coheres, right? Because that's what theology is, right? There has to be some ontological truth where there's one static, stable theology that the singular author of God, who is woven together all the biblical stories in a way, right, has for us. And it's our job to figure out that system, right? And as a biblical scholar, you know, all my training in biblical scholarship has shown, oh no, that story does not exist. The biblical authors are so diverse and so different, right? And so much the quest for biblical studies has been trying to get to that, the historical Jesus, and what is the true version of this story? Did Matthew get it right? Where's Luke? Did embellish this? And who's Luke as the theologian? And, you know, as I've been engaging, walking with these indigenous communities, I just laugh at myself and all the efforts that we've done in scholarship to do this. And it's just like, in some sense, nobody cares. Yeah. Yes, John has his view. Luke has his view. Like, also the sky is blue and the water runs. Like, duh. Yeah. And Yes, the history of the Christian tradition has interpreted Mary Magdalene in all different ways. Of course, why not? These are not surprising things, and we're not so anxious of getting at that right story. The question is, what is the story that you need to hear right now to move yourself back into harmony, put yourself right back in creation, right relationship with your family, with your community, and with your Creator God and Jesus, right? That's and I think we see this in, the way that Matthew tells a story, and Luke tells the same story to a very different end, and they can all be true because we're not trying to get at this mathematical truth of like recreating what was, if we were to have a video camera, what was filmed there, right? And so this orality and the importance of sort of reframing of stories is something that, like a good joke, the punchline stays the same, right? There are certain elements that always stay, but exactly how you nuance a story and how you retell the character arc and motivations of these characters and that will change. And there's room for a multiplicity of stories and a seasons for different variations. And I think that appreciation of indigenous storytelling in general has helped refine how I think about the Gospels, how I want to preach, and how I want to train those innates to preach, right? Even thinking about Paul's letters, right? Like, we could teach them as letters that become the ingredients for a systematic theology to work out, like, well, what is Paul's definitive view of soteriology or of this or that, right? Or are these artifacts of a larger story? How can we tell Paul's letters from a story perspective? These are all things I'm working with right now. And again, I think this touches us as human beings, right? Oh gosh. I mean, we bore people with systems. There are some people that love systems, right? I mean, again, there's all kinds of people, right? And God bless those people who want to focus that. But, I will bore my students when I talk about systems, but I will encapture and enchant them when I tell them, I approach the same information in story form. Because story, and this is an analogy that my uncle, Digi's uncle, Terry LeBlanc and Nates talks about, right? Story has all these hooks to it, right? And this is, knowledge that sticks with us, like Velcro. This is the Velcro analogy, right? Like, the more hooks that are in any kind of story or piece of knowledge in it, it's going to latch on to the fuzziness of who we are, right? And so story, the way in which it follows these generic forms, and we hear one story and we're like, oh, that's just like that story and that story, right? Like, it just hooks onto us in a way that, like, sterile textbooks with terms that, like, in a very organized process tries to lay out information to you, takes a bit more work to stay with you, right? But you tell a good story, that's going to be a durable lesson that's going to stick with you. In the same way, you sing a good song, and that's going to stay with you. And so it's not surprising then that so much, indigenous values and stories are embedded in songs and singing. And in the Ontrata Nation, right? When I've been going back to Oklahoma and having these conversations of can you tell me stories about what it looks like when you see a beautiful juxtaposition, when you see full resonance between the Christian tradition and your indigenous traditions? What comes to mind? And it's the Choctaw hymns. It's the singing of songs and hymns in the Choctaw language, in the Creek language, in Cherokee language that comes first to mind to everyone that I talk to. Because what I was expecting as a biblical scholar raised in Southern California was like, oh, you're going to have all these Bible stories. So you're going to tell me, right? Like, this is what I'm writing my book on, but they're going to tell me about songs that they sing. And I was frustrated for a while and like, okay, how can I get past this, right? Until I finally said, wake up, Chris, this is where the data is. This is the story right here that my Western conceptions, my Bibleolatry, like my framing and positioning, the foremost thing that's most important to my Christian faith is this book versus the life around this book and the songs that are generated from this book, the spiritual meanings of Jesus and people happens beyond this book and has always, and I'll stop right here, but I am humbled. I remind myself the vast majority of Christians that have ever existed in this world have been illiterate or have not framed their experience of Christianity by a book. So I will pause there because even here I find myself jumping from story to story. I'm just unpacking, and I don't want to completely lose your audience in this. So no, please recenter me in a question or a story that you like.
No, that's great. I love this notion as somebody who grew up very musically inclined. I love this idea of, and you're absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head talking about a story or a song rather that sticks with you is very similar to a story that sticks with you. You know, a modern interpretation of that would be, you know, a catchy song that you can't get the lyrics out of your head, or a movie you just saw. You know, we just had the Academy Awards, like a movie that really resonated deeply with you that, you know, you may not remember the finite details, but you'll remember the plot. You'll remember the gist of the movie, and you want to share it with other people around you. So I think that vehicle makes a lot of sense. But knowing that we are getting close to short on time or whatever, I definitely wanted you to talk a little bit about, obviously a big focus in Christianity is what happens next, what happens after, you know, the afterlife. What is the view? Because I know not all traditions really are, you know, not all traditions in not in all traditions is it a major issue or a major focus rather. So within Native American spirituality, I guess the question I'm trying to ask here is that a central thing that they focus on, or is that sort of a minor thing that they discuss within their traditions?
Again, it varies, right? So in the Christian story, right, in the linear way in which the Christian story is told, right, that all life in human history is coming to an apocalyptic end where there will be this final battle between good and evil. Good will win out, and there will be a general resurrection where human bodies will be restored, and there will be a return to a Garden of Eden on this world, right? And so there is this high anxiety, but also push, right, to save people's souls, to get people in right relationship with Jesus, because you want to be resurrected for the eternity that occurs afterwards, right? And it, you know, in some sense, it's a very linear, but even in that line, right, there is a circle that I don't think that Christians really appreciate or recognize, right? That at the heart of that story is always this return to a garden, is return back to a right relationship to the earth, where the earth is restored. And we see this in Romans 8, right? That our destiny is bound with earth, who Paul describing as a person, right, is groaning in birth pains, that Mother Earth, because mothers give birth, right, is groaning with birth pains for the full restoration of herself that somehow we have screwed up, right, in this story. And so our destinies are tied, and there is going to be some kind of return. Indigenous worldviews and pathways, right, that they see life as a cycle, and that what the human individual is beyond this world, I think, is a mystery and is something that different indigenous people have differing views about. But that said, right, there is this sustained belief that one's ancestors do exist somewhere in some sphere, in some plane, right? And that either... And I, you know, I don't want to get into the full ontology of how that looks like again, but that, you know, we see this in the Day of the Dead, which is, you know, an indigenous tradition from South America, right? Or in the ways in which indigenous people leave food out on their table, or that they have different recognitions that their ancestors are present, and that one ought to live in a way that brings honor to your ancestors, and that continues on their legacy in a good way. And so whatever is going to happen to us in our afterlife may be a mystery, but there's a real deep sense that our ancestors are watching over us, and there is some right relationship that we ought to have and respect toward them. And this sounds superstitious to the evangelical mind, but I will say, go back to the Hebrew Bible, because there are elements of this throughout. Like, indigenous people are much more similar to the peoples of the Hebrew nations than any Western Christian has in the last 500 years, right, of modernity. I mean, why is it the case that when they talk about the God of Israel, it's always the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? It's constant ancestors. That when Israel goes from Egypt to the back to the promised land, that they dig up the bones of Joseph and of their ancestors, and they're carrying them to the promised land, that there is some relationship that they're gonna, that they want their family with them. And we see this in Hebrews, right? This cloud of witnesses that are watching us and cheering us on in the faith. And are we only to imagine that those witnesses are only a bunch of group of men and a few women, right? The patriarchs, right? Or are those the ones that are the forefront in the mind, the storyteller of Hebrews? But if that really is a cloud of indiscriminate ancestors, that your ancestors too are there cheering you on. I had a student, Christina, who is just wonderful, who wrote a whole paper thinking about this and wanting to think about, can I as an indigenous woman participate in these ceremonies that bring honor to my ancestors from a Christian perspective? Where, what room is there? What cultural seeds of imaginations are there within our sacred texts of the Bible that might signal that this is okay if one needs permission for this? And I would say, you know, coming from an indigenous perspective, looking at Christianity, there are elements that have always been there that have been under appreciation, forgotten, or negated because of a dualistic Greek philosophy that kind of came through that then evolved in, you know, into the modern Western Enlightenment way of thinking that said, well, that's heresy, that's paganism, that's animism. We've never done that, right? Mm-hmm. And there are other ways of interpreting these passages. And I would say some of these indigenous instincts that are not just indigenous, right? We see this in China. We see it across the globe. People have been thinking about what does it mean to live in right relationship to my ancestors, that actually Western, modern, Protestant evangelicals are the unicorns in human history that have said, I don't think about anything with this, right? Even in Mormonism, right, there's this baptism for the dead, right? That's coming from 1 Corinthians. And we're just like, what does this mean? I don't know. Whatever it means, it can't mean the Mormons because they're, you know, the Latter-day Saints, because they're wrong. But even Joseph Smith is like tapping into this sense of like, what is it like to be thoughtful about our ancestors, those who have gone on, right? So that's kind of a way to get at, there's not so much anxiety over the forward thinking of, is there going to be a heaven or hell or justice, right? I think innate to a lot of people's, right, there is this sense of justice. There is this sense of this hope that whatever lies on the other side, that I am going to be in relationship with the people I love the most, and that I'm going to be loved, and I'm going to be reunited with the Creator, that it's going to be good, right? I think every person hopes that. And also, I think there's some hope that the people who've done us wrong, either they will be restored and made right, or that there's going to be some kind of punishment. And we see this throughout the whole Christian tradition, right? Even Origen thinks long and hard that if God's love is truly love and all powerful, right? And that if hell, because what hell can't be is a universal, just that God gets his pleasure out of like hurting, destroying people, right? That God is some vindictive monster that, like, you know, because you didn't believe these right things, is just going to torture you forever, right? Like, no human parent thinks like this. All discipline is meant to teach and restore right relationship, right? And even Origen is tapping into this and thinking, if discipline is meant for education, then hell and purgatory, whatever that is meant to educate. Even the devil himself is going to get educated in infinite time with infinite love. Because how can you resist the irresistible love of God and God as tutor, right? For hell to not to be evacuated at some point is a failure of an all-loving God. So in Origen, as I tell students in my early Christian class, this is the smartest we have, right? Like, the dude is brilliant. He'll get called for heresy, but everyone who calls him a heresy is stupider than Origen, has not thought through all these things. And you can still disagree with him, but there's that. I mean, you see this in C.S. Lewis. We see this, all these thinkers, right, that are all just trying to think about. And even at the heart of this apocalyptic tale of good versus evil, what they're all leading to is harmony, of getting people back in right relationship with Aslan, right? At the last battle, secretly C.S. Lewis is a universalist that, you know, or some sense that all these other people are, that Aslan's counting their work to service him. And so I think this, the indigenous intuition, maybe we might call it, is that that harmony doesn't just exist in life and death in both ends, but exists now. And so we're always in this cyclical, seasonal sense of restoring harmony throughout the seasons, throughout the moments of life. And even the prayers, the seven directions, right? You've east, west, north, south, up, sky, down, ground, into your heart, right? We're not just, you know, indigenous people aren't just praying to like the spirits of the four corners, right? But this also becomes opportunities to think about that your life right now is in context. You are placed, you are spatialized in relationship to things. And each of these things, each direction becomes a helpful opportunity to think about all the things associated with the circle of life and with every being that exists in these different directions. And that your existence is contingent in relationship with everything. And so this is an opportunity to be thankful, to organize your prayers, to be thoughtful. I mean, this is a practice that I've watched my elders do and that I've been trying to live out my life. And I teach my kids in Sunday school that it's just such a helpful a space to pray in. But there is this cyclical nature. There is this thinking and rest, you know. You know, I'm pausing it here, but I'm going to get off my train here because I know we're on time, but I could go off and keep talking.
No, I love that. I think that's a beautiful way to look at things and a perfect way to end, I think. So I want to say a huge thank you. This is fascinating. And I know we could have probably done like three more hours easily and still not covered everything. So I think that means we have to have you back at some point to continue to cover more.
Well, you know, and this is about relationship. And this is something that I have been thinking about a lot with Nate, is that, you know, we're all on this journey together. And so, you know, kind of the capitalist, you know, thing is like, oh, let me just extract this information from this Christian Indian and put it on my podcast and go. Or what would it look like to be in relationship, right? To have you as a deconstructionist podcast come to Nate's annual meeting and get to know more of us, right? And to invite us back and to keep this conversation going. And you in turn, when our relationship with you, you are introducing to a whole number of people, some of whom we already have a relationship with, like Brian McLaren has been a friend of the community for a long time, and introducing to others who we want to get in relationship. So, because the heart of it, I think the richness of doing theology and thinking these thoughts are not just the thoughts and beauty we produce, but, you know, to sound cliche, it's the friendships we make along the way, right?
Absolutely.
Of the journey. So yes, I'm happy to be a friend of the podcast, be a friend of you, John, and to keep this conversation going. And I tell you what, we are having exciting conversations with Nate of what it looks like to do ministry and to think and train ministers from an indigenous perspective, from the ground up, whether it's reframing biblical studies in terms of stories of telling indigenous history from an asset-based approach that doesn't just say, well, let's, you know, talk about all the problems and talk about Indians as problems, right? But let's approach our stories from what we have to offer and the strengths we bring, and how can this be trauma-informed and in conversation with Christianity. So, you know, we are trying out a lot of things, and I think our hope is that we're going to have something to give to the wider non-Indigenous community as well, as we all think about what it means to live this life in a good way.
Well, I think that's been the biggest gift of doing this podcast, is the relationships that, you know, I've been able to forge over the years, and definitely to keep these types of conversations going. And so, yeah, before I let you go, though, where can people go to stay up on top of your work? And then also, do you have any sense for when the book might be out, or is it still pretty early in the...
Yeah, so we are in the process of writing it. It is due to InterVarsity Press at the end of next summer, 2024, so probably published in 2025. I mean, you can always Google Chris Hakla-Tubby, and you'll find different works that have been... You know, my indigenous stuff is out there in a lot of different volumes. You can always feel free to shoot me an email, and I will send you PDFs of my work. But let me, again, in relationship, I recommend people check out naits.com. That's naiits.com. It has a journal associated with it. These journal articles are filled with brilliant minds, indigenous Christians who have been thinking about this for 25 years and over. And there's such a richness to this. Again, I want to lift up the work of my friend Danny Zacharias, Randy Woodley, Tink Tinker, Stephen Charlson, especially. You know, I see him as a spiritual grandfather in terms of just the intellectual production he's producing. In terms, Four Vision Quests of Jesus is one of the most underrated works on Indigenous Christianity. And I have already mentioned Caitlin Curtis and others. So I'm always happy to give recommendations on this journey. And please check out our annual meetings. We really welcome a lot of people to join us and to walk on this path with us.
That's awesome. Well, we'll put all the links we can in the show notes there, and so that people have some resources and know where to go. But yeah.
And before I close, one last thing. He's going to be angry that I forgot, but there is an online Indigenous church community called Good Medicine Way, led by my friend Casey Church. And they stream on Facebook, Good Medicine Way. They do fantastic work there too. And I want to also just take the opportunity to shout out them as well. So I'll end there. Of course, I could talk about Randy Woodley's Elohe Farms as well. There's so many people we're plugging again because they're just amazing stories that abound.
I love it. Well, again, we'll make sure that we include the links in the show notes. So if you didn't happen to write that down just now, it's okay. I will do the work for you. So it'll be in the show notes. But Chris, thanks again. This was absolutely fascinating, and I really appreciate some of your time.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. We have a body or even a name. If he does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care? His face must look like yours. Did God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God. Looks like us. Does God know my name? Is the ache in my soul just confined to my brain? Even so, does that mean it's not real? So take a breath. A face, her face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. Face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome.